Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 228, and we're going to talk about fire extinguishers. This might sound boring, but I promise you that if you find yourself in need of one without one, it's not boring. We're also gonna talk about space blankets. You know, those shiny Mylar things? Are they any good? And we'll talk about the difference between gasoline and diesel heaters, as well as some tales from Bermuda. Hello, folks. I apologize profusely, mea culpa, for I was not able to produce a podcast last week because I was traveling the Atlantic and going to Bermuda and Newport, Rhode Island, and the ship that I was on has Starlink, and I thought everything's going to be fine. But when I got on board, I found out that they have Starlink, but it's not turned on yet. Their contract doesn't begin until November, so I had to use this old, they told me it was from the military, some really old version of the internet, which had about 1 megabit down and like old-fashioned modem speeds up, and it was just going to be a nightmare trying to produce it. So instead, I spent the week having a good time with my wife, and I will never regret doing that. So I apologize, but here we are. Let's dive right into some content here. I have been doing some research on fire extinguishers, and if you've listened to my podcast at all, you know I'm a big advocate of fire extinguishers. The very first thing you should buy when you're considering van life is a fire extinguisher. Buy that before you buy the van. But we should probably drill down a bit on what kind of fire extinguisher. And I've been talking to my firefighter friends and doing research online, and well, I've got a list here of things to consider. First, you have to consider, what is a fire extinguisher? Well, it's anything that puts out a fire, obviously, but not all fires are the same, and not all fire extinguishers are the same. There are ratings for fire extinguishers, A, B, C, D, and K. I don't know what happened to the other letters there, but they're gone. So we only have those five to worry about. In reality, we don't even have those five to worry about, because D and K are weird, but we'll talk about them. Let's just go right down the list here. Class A Class A fire is wood and cloth and paper. A campfire is a Class A fire. If your trash barrel catches on fire because someone threw a cigarette butt in your papers, that's a Class A fire. Most people can put these out with water, and if you have just a Class A fire extinguisher, it's going to be just water. Don't want these. We'll get into that in a bit, but that's the most basic kind. Class B is a little bit more complicated because it's an oil fire. A gasoline fire, an oil fire, diesel, any kind of thing that contains oil or solvent like paints, things like that, alcohol, flammable gases, those are all called Class B fires. And why are they a different class than Class A? Because Class A you can put out with water, Class B you can't necessarily, because the burning oils will float on the water and possibly create a bigger problem. So that's a big distinction. Class C fires are something that we care about a lot in vans. Those are fires that involve energized electrical equipment. So if you have any kind of electrical short that's heating up and it's causing a fire, Class C is what you want. So that's a very important one to remember. Now, a Class D fire, well, technically, we kind of could get into that in van life. Class D fires are combustible metals. If you ever did that experiment in school where they take a little bit of pure elemental sodium and throw it in the water, and it explodes and dances around and there's fire, oh, yeah, that's a Class D fire. A Class D fire is also what happens when your lithium battery explodes. So do we need Class D fire extinguishers in vans? Probably not, even though we can technically encounter a Class D fire. We'll talk about that more in a bit, too. Now, Class K fires sound like something we would care about. They are fires in cooking appliances that involve combustible cooking media like oil. So if the fryolator at McDonald's catches fire, that's a Class K fire. But the reason that's a separate class is because of the quantity. That is, commercial quantities of oils. We're not going to have that in a van. So we can skip Class K completely. Those are the extinguishers that are built into the fry stations at fast food restaurants. We don't have to worry about that. The important thing to add on to this is that a fire extinguisher can be more than one class. So for most people not in industrial settings, the two kinds of extinguishers you're going to encounter are Class ABC and Class BC. And it's very popular for vehicles to have just BC extinguishers because I guess they're like, well, you're in a vehicle, there's no wood in here, we don't need it. However, if you can, I recommend you get all Class A, B, C, because we're not just in our vehicles. We're out in the woods or whatever. You may actually have a wood fire that's a concern. So having a Class A extinguisher would help. Now, using a Class B, C extinguisher on a Class A fire, a wood fire, a paper fire, will probably help put it out. There's no danger in doing that. But you do want to have the best possible fire extinguisher at hand. So talking to my firefighter friend, he recommends a Class ABC. If you can get that, ABC is the best for this application. Why not a D? Well, first off, they're not common. They're not necessarily easy to find. They're expensive. The other reason is that a lithium battery fire is pretty severe. There's so much energy stored in lithium batteries that they're almost impossible for someone to put out. The recommended way of putting out a lithium battery fire is to douse it in water, such as if you have, like, say, the lithium battery for a power tool and it's doing bad things. What you're supposed to do is drop it in a bucket of water. Of course, you have to pick it up to put it in the water. If your main lithium battery bank is going, well, you're in trouble because you can't douse the entire thing. And the best thing to do is just get the heck out of the way, call the fire department, and let them handle it. Well, arguably, we should have Class K fire extinguishers. It's just not ultimately practical. So take steps to make sure that your lithium batteries are safe from any type of thing that will puncture it. Put in a lot of fuses, I've said that before, and definitely have the ABC fire extinguisher. Now, one thing we have to worry about in vans that you don't have to worry about in your house, mostly, is freezing. So Class A fire extinguishers, you're usually water-based, and, you know, water freezes. This can be a problem. So what about your fire extinguisher freezing? Is that a bad thing? Well, not really. Most modern fire extinguishers that have water, and they don't all, have an antifreeze put in there. So they're going to be good to normal temperatures that you're going to experience. So don't worry about that. What's actually a bigger risk is that the powder in there will cake up and stop being loose. So it's recommended that you shake your fire extinguishers a couple times a year. Like, say, when you replace your smoke detector battery every 6 months, unless it's a lithium, you might want to shake your fire extinguishers too. However, being in vans, they're kind of getting shaken a bit as we drive around. That helps, but it's good to give them a good solid shake every once in a while. Now, what size should you have? One thing Pat, my firefighter friend, pointed out is that the small fire extinguishers, the 2-pound fire extinguishers, which are fairly common in vehicles, are just enough to protect you to get away from the vehicle. You're probably not going to save your vehicle with one of these. The fire is not going to be put out. It's just going to make a path for you. A 5-pound fire extinguisher, which is what I actually have in the back of my ambulance, will give you 2.5 times as much chance of saving your vehicle. But an important thing to remember with all this talk about fire extinguishers is the point isn't to save your vehicle. The point is to save you. Saving your vehicle is a bonus if you can do it. So you should have the largest size that will fit. For me, in a van, I think most people can probably find space for a 5-pound. That's what I have linked in the show notes if you're looking for one that meets everything I'm talking about. It's a 5-pound fire extinguisher. Now, if you're in a minivan or something like that, sure, you might want a 2-pound. But side note here, do not look for those really small ones. You may see there are some that look like aerosol cans. I mean, they could be hairspray, except they're a fire extinguisher. They're very inexpensive. They're not going to do much. They are really not advisable. That's the kind of thing that maybe if you had a pan that caught fire because the oil got too hot, it would put out that really quickly. But why? Why bother taking up the space with that when you should really have a bigger one to begin with? And now there are these new ones that look like road flares. They're kind of like sticks, and they're very compact, and they're very expensive. I've watched a bunch of YouTube videos on those, and they just don't work very well. So if you really want to have one of those, like if you want to like put it in your backpack or something, okay, that's fine. But they're not a replacement for the larger fire extinguishers. So get the largest size you can. And remember, size you can doesn't just mean space. It also means weight. A 5-pound fire extinguisher weighs about 10 pounds. Most people can lift that. But if you start getting into these giant fire extinguishers, you might be in a situation where, hey, you've got all the power in the world to put out the fire, but nobody can lift it. So that's not such a great thing. Now, where do you put this fire extinguisher that you have purchased? Well, in my ambulance. Now, remember, my ambulance was professionally designed for safety personnel, so they made decisions based on lots of experience. In my ambulance, the fire extinguisher is immediately as you open the slider, which on mine is on the passenger side. Open the passenger side slider, and the fire extinguisher is right there. You can reach it from the outside of the vehicle. It's very easy to grab. Now, my ambulance was designed to have a crew of 2 or 3 people in it. So there was always somebody in the back. What if I rolled the van over? What if the van was laying on its side and caught fire? I probably couldn't get to that fire extinguisher. So there's an argument to be made that you should also have a fire extinguisher securely mounted somewhere where the driver can reach it while they're in the driver's seat. So, ideally, you should have 2 fire extinguishers in your van. And what I would recommend, if you can do this, is put a 5-pounder in the back somewhere that's easily accessible from one of the doors, and a 2-pounder, one of the smaller ones, somewhere where the driver can reach it. That is going to give you the safest possible situation for fire extinguishers. I mean, all right, you could put one under the hood, too. And what about on the outside? What about... Anyway, but we have to draw some lines here somewhere. We're not building fire trucks. But a 2-pound up front, a 5-pound in the back, boy, you would be ready to deal with almost anything you needed to protect yourself. How do you use a fire extinguisher? If you've never used one before, you do have to take some time learning exactly what to do. It's not as simple as, well, you point it at the fire. I mean, yes, but there's a technique to it. So if you have an old expired fire extinguisher, build yourself a campfire and put it out. Try it. See what happens. You will learn very quickly that the way to put out a fire is to sweep at the base of the fire, the base of the fire. Forget the flames. It's where the flames are coming from that you care about. In a gentle sweeping motion, spray down the source of the fire until the fire goes out. And then watch. First off, make sure you're safe. Remember, this is about your safety. If you have time and everything's under control, keep a watch on that until the fire department comes and makes sure it's out. There are 2 different narratives here I've heard for what you should do. One, and I heard this from a firefighter, is you should never leave your fire extinguisher half full, meaning that if there's a fire, use the entire extinguisher, even if the fire's out. Just keep dumping it on there because a half full fire extinguisher is useless. You might as well use it to prevent the fire from coming back. However, there's another narrative, which is that once the fire's out, stop spraying the fire extinguisher, and then be ready in case the fire comes back. Because in the first scenario, if you use your whole fire extinguisher and the fire comes back anyway, you're then powerless to combat that. So, I can see both arguments, but can tell you that the one time I've actually had to use a fire extinguisher for an actual fire, I used the second technique, which was I put it out, and then I waited and watched and waited till the fire department came, which they did, and then they put it out for real, and it was fine. People will think I'm joking about this, but I'm dead serious. You really need to do fire drills. Practice. You want to build up a little bit of muscle memory, or at least mental memory, that, hey, there's a fire, what do I do? Where is the fire extinguisher? How easy is it to get to? And when you do this practice, you want to maybe set an alarm on your watch or your clock or your phone or whatever. And when that alarm goes off, it's a fire. What do you do? What do you do? And what you're going to do is you're going to go to your fire extinguisher, remove it from the bracket, get it completely ready to use. And you don't have to use it, of course. By doing that, you're going to be much more ready if there's an actual fire, because that little bit of training is going to help you know what to do in a time when you might be panicking. So I highly recommend that you do that. Now, the truth is that if you use your fire extinguisher in your van, you're going to have an enormous mess. A lot of the components in modern fire extinguishers are corrosive to metals. So if you've put out the fire and your van isn't totaled, it's worth saving, you need to clean that stuff out as fast as you can, and that's a big job. But don't let that stop you from using your fire extinguisher. If you're in danger of any kind from fire, use the extinguisher. It's much better to clean up your van than to just write it off, because there are endless videos of what happens. Also, be realistic. If you have an electrical fire in the back of your van and you're there, you can probably put it out with the fire extinguisher, remembering that a big part of that is to turn off the power, disconnect the battery somehow. If it's a propane fire, same thing, although you should really get the heck out of there as soon as you can, but turning off the propane will stop the fire. If you're in that situation, you can probably save your vehicle, maybe kinda. If you have an engine fire, if there's gasoline involved, or diesel, or something like that, if there's fire coming out from under the hood, you should probably just give up. Because think about it. There's so much fuel there feeding that fire that your extinguisher is not going to be sufficient. You're not going to be able to save your vehicle. So have the mindset that you're not trying to save your vehicle, you're trying to save you. And while vehicles generally don't explode like you see in the movies, if the fuel tank heats up enough, it can explode. And you have to consider that you really just need to protect yourself and get away from the vehicle. That is the main purpose of a fire extinguisher. Go get a fire extinguisher. I know half of you listening to me don't have a fire extinguisher. Go get one. Please, it could save your life, it could save the life of somebody else. And remember, you're on the road driving a lot. You might see somebody on the side of the road with their car on fire. This happened to me not that long ago. You might be the one to save them with your fire extinguisher. So, link in the show notes, but heck, I'm pretty sure you know where to get one. Special thank you to Captain Swift for helping to support Built to Go in an ad-free format. Folks, if you like listening to podcasts without ads, one way you can do that is to visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. And buy me a gallon of diesel. One time, $5. Buy me a few gallons of diesel if you like the show a lot, whatever. All that helps keep ads off the show, and I appreciate it. Everybody appreciates it. And it allows me to just go on with some more content. Van Life News. Hey, you may have seen some reports about the BLM hiking fees, and it's true. The BLM, we talk about it a lot as a free place to camp in the U.S., but it actually varies depending on where you're going to camp on BLM land. There's dispersed camping, there are established campsites, and there are long-term campsites in places like Quartzsite that have different fees. And what's happening is the BLM, apparently, according to them, is they've looked at the market prices and decided that they're not charging enough money. And they've hiked the fees a lot in some areas. So the place of most concern is the LTVA areas. These are like Quartzsite, where they're long-term camping areas. The LTVA is long-term visitor area. They're in Quartzsite and Yuma, and the fees are not cheap. I mean, well, they're not expensive, but a 7-month permit used to be $180, and now it's going to be $600. Yeah. Now, they used to have 2-week permits in these areas, and they were $40, which is certainly reasonable, but they were going to raise that to $200, which is still, compared to a normal campground, not bad. But it is a problem. Now, does this mean this is the end of BLM land camping for the United States? No, this is just these particular areas. The established campgrounds are probably going to have higher prices, and this is for the 2026 camping season, so you're still good for next year. I'll have a link in the show notes to the article. You can read it for yourself. The RV people in their community are freaking out about this, and, well, it is a little bit of a concern, but I don't ultimately think it's going to matter that much for the way most of us camp. If you're in the U.S., you may have noticed that gas prices are falling. Yes, I have seen prices well below $3 a gallon near me, or at least near me in the other part of the state. Chicago doesn't count. And, that's great. That helps us out in every way. The cheapest parts of the country now are in the South, as usual. They tend to have fewer taxes on gasoline. So, you know, places like Texas, Louisiana, Missouri, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, Tennessee, all they're likely going to have the cheapest prices. In Chicago and Illinois, unfortunately, we're one of the higher states, so it doesn't help so much for us. But still, it's a lot cheaper than it has been, and it's only going to get cheaper. The price is going to keep going down because we're about to switch over from summer fuel to winter fuel. There are different fuels, there's different formulations, and winter fuel is cheaper. So that is some good news. However... that is not true if you're in California. California prices are going up, if you can believe it. And I know that if you live in California, you can. There's a strange situation right now, which is that California prices are going up and the rest of the country's going down. If you live in California, you probably think this happens all the time. But in this specific case, it's because California uses its own blend of gasoline. It's a separate blend just for California. I'm sure it's for some environmental reasons. And that blend of gasoline isn't going down in price. It's actually going up. And that will continue, so say the experts, until October when California switches over to winter blend. So if you're hitting the road, you might want to avoid California at this time and stick to the South. However, it's still hot down there. So maybe you want to go to Ohio, which has some of the cheaper fuel in the North and is going to be a little bit more temperate in coming days. And finally, a bit of news that I don't like to share. Remote jobs are in peril. Living on the road full-time, often people need to have a remote job where it doesn't matter where they are, they're just going to work from wherever they are. This is the kind of job I have gotten used to. I haven't actually had a job where I had to go in the office every day since 1999. Seriously. For the jobs I've had since 1999, I've always been remote, and I can't imagine working any other way. But all the big companies are saying, you have to come back into the office. Google, Amazon... all over the market, we're finding more and more companies either reducing their hybrid work, where you can work from home some days and in the office other days, or just saying, nope, back to normal. Everyone's in the office 9 to 5 every day, or as we know in reality, 8 to 7. But there's a weird corollary to this. Most people want remote jobs now. So the companies offering remote work are getting the better candidates. So it's an interesting situation where we have companies switching to in-office, but we have the working pool of people saying that they want to work from home. So we'll have to see how this shakes out. I have friends, very highly paid programmer-type folks, who just simply won't work in an office. They're done with that. They're never going to do it again. So they won't work for any of these companies that say you have to be in the office. And I think eventually... we're going to find an equilibrium here where there'll be some remote jobs and some office jobs. But anyway, not good news for us because we don't have the option of going into the office if we're 300 miles from the office. Tech Talk. Gasoline versus diesel heaters. We all know now about the cheap Chinese diesel heaters. The Chinese engineers have basically copied more expensive diesel heaters designed by Webasto and Eberspacher and these other companies, and they've done a pretty good job of it. Honestly, the $100 cheap Chinese diesel heaters work really well. But a lot of folks say, "But oh, that's great, but they're diesel. I've got gasoline in my van. Why do I need an extra tank to put diesel in? Why don't I just get one that runs on gasoline?" And when I first started talking about these things on the podcast years ago now, there really weren't any gasoline heaters available in the U.S. anyway. There were a few, but they were kind of gray market, and actually contacted, I think it was Eberspacher, and asked, and they said that they weren't approved for use in the U.S., and that if you found one and installed it, you wouldn't get any support. And the other part was that they cost about $1,300. They were very expensive. So I kind of wrote off gasoline heaters. But years pass, and now if you look on Amazon, you can find gasoline heaters. Now, these things are called parking heaters, generically. And you can find gasoline parking heaters. So if you have a Ford Transit with a gasoline engine, which is a fine vehicle, you can just hook it right up into the tank and not have to have a separate tank. And great. Except, here's the except part. They're expensive. The cheapest one I was able to find was $600, and it's a 2 kilowatt. That's the lowest power possible. So you've got that right off the bat. But what concerns me more isn't the expense, it's the nature of gasoline versus diesel. You may or may not realize, but all school buses are diesel by law. And why is that? It's because if there's an accident on the highway, diesel doesn't explode. Diesel will burn, obviously, but it doesn't explode. And that'll give the kids much more time to get out of the vehicle. It's a safer fuel. It doesn't vaporize. Gasoline liquid doesn't actually burn. It's the vapor that burns. And in a gasoline engine, the spark plugs ignite the vapor of gasoline. Gasoline will vaporize at room temperature, just about any temperature that we're going to experience as humans. And that means that your gasoline heater is going to have vapor in it. And vapor escapes a lot easier than diesel. So the concern is that if anything goes wrong with your gasoline heater, it's a much bigger risk than it is with a diesel heater. And since we're doing this DIY stuff, it's all kind of in the gray, and you know, there aren't that many standards, and we're just kind of figuring out as we go, it's a much more costly mistake with a gasoline heater than it is with a diesel heater. So I highly recommend a diesel heater over a gasoline heater, unless you really know what you're doing or have a professional to install it. And you should check that thing constantly if you put a gasoline heater in your van. Diesel has a nice odor that you can smell, and if you smell it, one drop, you can smell it in your van. That's great. And you can just look and see if there's a leak, and you can fix it, and it's fine. But gasoline, you can have vapors that can ignite with a spark and explode. It's a much bigger problem. So I'll have a link in the show notes to an actual gasoline heater that I found on Amazon so you can see that they exist. But I can't say I recommend them. Product review. So you've seen those space blankets? You know, they're basically sheets of Mylar. If you've seen Reflectix, Reflectix is bubble wrap with a layer of Mylar on it, which is like a plasticized aluminum. Very shiny, very cool things, and you see them in every survival kit in the world. And that's what's for. You also see them at the end of marathons, like the end of the Boston Marathon every year. You see people huddled under their space blankets. These are for emergency use. They're typically disposable. And that's the way they should stay. I was on a camping trip in southeastern Oregon, and it got surprisingly cold. I brought my summer sleeping bag with me, which was a mistake. I was sleeping in an unheated tent trailer. I froze my butt off, so I reached into my kit and pulled out my space blanket, and it didn't do a darn thing. Honestly, I didn't recognize any more heat being retained with this space blanket, and also is noisy as hell. If you try to sleep under one of these things, it's like trying to sleep while you're making Jiffy Pop. It's all crinkly, and bottom line is, space blankets are good for emergencies, and they're incredibly inexpensive. So if you want to buy some to just have in the van, that's fine. But they're going to work best wrapped around you like a burrito. They are not something you're going to put over your sleeping bag like a blanket. It just doesn't do that much good. Remember, like Reflectix, that coating is a radiant barrier, so the radiant heat coming off your body will be reflected back to you. And ideally, they're useful when you don't have a sleeping bag. You use that instead of a sleeping bag. But if you have a sleeping bag, the sleeping bag is going to do a whole lot more. So just a reality check for space blankets. I do have a link in the show notes. They are good for emergencies. You find someone freezing on the side of the road, it will help. But they're not a staple of van life. Tales from the road. So, obviously, I just went to Bermuda. I had a great trip on this ship, Oceana Insignia. And even though it's spelled Oceania, they pronounce it Oceana. There's a whole story behind that. This is not a cruise podcast, and I know some of you think it's absolutely weird that somebody is doing van life and cruising because they seem like such opposite things, but to me they seem very similar because to me the ship is just a big van that goes in the water. Anyway, I love the ship. I had a great time. It's like old school cruising where they weren't nickel and diming you to death and nobody was trying to sell you stuff. You just got on the ship and had a good time. It was wonderful. That said, we went to Newport, Rhode Island, talk a little bit about that later, but we also went to Bermuda. Bermuda is a unique place, and a lot of people have misconceptions about it. Forget the Bermuda Triangle. It's not real. Nobody in Bermuda thinks anything of that. But Bermuda also isn't in the Caribbean, and the Bermudians will be very quick to tell you we're not the Caribbean. There's some Caribbean influence. Some of that's just because they're in an island. There are actually some legal definitions that make Bermuda part of the Caribbean for some social reasons, but they are not in the Caribbean by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, Bermuda is closer to Nova Scotia, Canada, than even the Bahamas, and the Bahamas aren't in the Caribbean either. So I thought, what about van life in Bermuda? I mean, why not? It's big enough. You could find different places, and it's beautiful, and, well, there's a few problems with this. First, the speed limit on Bermuda is 35 kilometers an hour. The maximum speed limit on the entire island. Oh, USAians, you don't do metric. I understand. That is 22 miles per hour. 22 miles per hour. That's the maximum speed. And actually, it's less than that. It's like 21.7. Anyway. Okay. Driving on Bermuda is an interesting experience. Very narrow roads, very windy, you can't see around corners, and they drive on the left in Bermuda because it's a former British colony. So you've got some driving challenges. However, hey, if you can only go 21 miles an hour, you don't need much of a vehicle, right? And you will, when you get over there, you see there are a lot of K-vans and K-trucks, K-E-I. Little tiny vans and trucks, and boy, you could make a pretty nice camper out of those if you were clever. However, of all the places I've been, I think Bermuda is the first place that I have been that had not a single camper van on it. I went all over the island. I went to Hamilton, St. George's, the dockyards, everywhere in between. We rode the buses. The public transportation there is actually pretty good. Took the ferry. Not a single camper van there. Also, not a single campground there. Folks, you can't do van life on Bermuda. That's the bottom line. No, it really isn't possible. There would be no place for you to park. Parking is a huge problem on Bermuda. There are way more cars than you would think for a population of 62,000 people. And there just isn't enough space for them. And, you know, to bring over my Sprinter ambulance there, it would be one of the largest vehicles on the island, and there would be no place to put it. So, yeah, we have found a place that you can't do van life, really. Stealth camping, like if you had a little vehicle and you had, like, you know, a Steve Wallace kind of camping with Steve situation, yeah, you could find some places to camp. You could actually probably find caves to camp in there. There's a lot of caves on the island and a lot of abandoned tunnels. You could probably do that. But vans, no. And that said, I saw more vans there, more different kinds of vans than I'd see in the U.S. Very, very few U.S. vehicles in Bermuda, like much of the world. And I'm still just so jealous of all these little vans they have. I took pictures of them all, but boy, so many cool little cargo vans that you can get outside the U.S., and I was a little jealous of that. So I love Bermuda. It's a bit expensive. It's an island, of course, but it's not in the Caribbean. You can stop making that mistake, and if you get a chance to go, you absolutely should go. It is such a different experience from all the other islands, and even on that island, it's a different experience. You've got the dockyards, which is very cruise-oriented and very touristy. You've got Hamilton, which is like a big city, and yeah, there's tourism, but they don't really care. And then you've got St. George's, which is this beautiful little ancient area with all these cute 300-400-year-old buildings, very touristy, but very kind of Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard kind of expensive and elite and not a lot of chains. One last thing about Bermuda that I thought was weird. Nobody knew what the price of gas was. Whenever I had a chance to talk to a Bermudian, and most of them are extremely friendly people, they don't know how much gas is because they don't buy it very often. And when you go by the gas stations on the island, the price isn't even advertised. I could not find out what the price was. I would have to go to the pump and reset it to see what the price is. It just doesn't matter because they use so little fuel that it's like, eh, who cares? So I thought that was interesting. A place to visit. This place is very specific. This is a store. I stumbled across this store while walking around Newport, Rhode Island, and I'm going to recommend an actual store just for the experience. It used to be that when you traveled, shopping was a big part of it because you could get things you couldn't get anywhere else, and prices were different maybe, and it was just a fun thing to actually see new stuff. But in modern times where everybody gets everything from Amazon, and when you go from port to port to port, all the shops are the same, or heck, you go to a strip mall in Oklahoma, it has the same stores as a strip mall in Idaho, as in Texas, as in Maine. The shopping thing is just not a thing anymore. And this store belies that. This is a unique store. There is stuff in this store you're not going to find anywhere else. The name of the store is The Royal Mail. And that's M-A-L-E, Royal Mail. You see, it's a joke. You know that dry British humor? Yeah, they've got that here. In fact, this store is the most British thing I've encountered in the United States. It's a British clothing store for men and women. It's just a joke, folks. It's not actually the way it is. And they have clothing that I've not seen anywhere else. And I could get in real trouble there. Again, very British. When you go in the store, it's decorated in a very British fashion. It's an old place. You can tell there's history here. And they sell things like Nero suits and safari jackets. And my wife bought a bunch of St. James clothes that are for like the boating crowd. And a lot of the stuff is made just for the store. It's not stuff you can find on Amazon. If you want this stuff, you have to go to them. And I was talking with the woman who is running the place, and apparently she and her husband own this, and he used to be a fur buyer for the Hudson Bay Company. I mean, the heritage is just amazing. Now, it's not cheap. You can easily spend $500 on a jacket here. This obviously isn't clothing for most van life. I get that. That's not why I'm saying you should visit this place. You should visit this place because it is a unique shopping experience, which is something we really don't have very much of anymore. I have traveled the world, and it is amazing to me how little variance there is in shopping, especially when you're in a tourist area, which this is. Newport, Rhode Island is a tourist town. They have an online presence. I will link to their website, but they don't use it. The owners are not terribly wired. You know, they've got a fancy website, but it says at the top the website's been turned off. You really need to go visit this yourself. You don't have to buy anything. You can if you want. If you're looking for bow ties or some British golfing socks, heck, this is the place. And that safari jacket almost came home with me, but it was too much money. Anyway, travel is about finding unique things and having unique experiences. This place provides that, and I was very happy to go inside. And no, they're not paying me to make this. It's not an ad. The Royal Mail, Newport, Rhode Island. It's on 104 Spring Street, right by the waterfront, and it's been there since 1983. Resource recommendation. This resource recommendation is going to be for a very few of you, but some of you have really built out nice vans, and maybe you want to customize it just a little bit more. Well, there are companies now making custom badges for vans. You know, I'm talking about the badges that say Ford or Mercedes or ProMaster, all those kind of things. You can get custom ones of those, and it's easy now. Obviously, you could always get custom ones if you found the artist willing to make them, but now it's easy. You can actually do it on Amazon. Now, I have not used this service. I'm only giving you this link so you know that it exists. There are many companies doing this. But if you go on Amazon and search custom badges, you will find a number of companies that can make a badge for you. So if you've made this beautiful van and you've named it and you want to commemorate that name somehow, you can actually have this little badge made, and some of them will stick on, some of them will bolt on. You get to choose that. And it will just add that final bit of customization to your van, almost like a christening in a way. If that is something that appeals to you, I just want to make you aware that it exists. And like everything else, it's on Amazon. So I have a link in the show notes. Take a look and see if it's something that interests you. And so just a quick note here. As you know, I end every episode with a quote. If you've turned it off at the credits, you're missing out. There's always a fancy quote at the end, and it's not that big of a deal. But some people like them. They've asked me to compile them, which I haven't done. I'm sorry. I'm not that organized. But there's a specific quote I just wanted to talk about very quickly because it relates to travel. And it's a quote that you will see very often in travel quotes. You know, it's, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts." And the rest of the quote that is often left out is, "Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." And I just wanted to highlight that a bit because there's a lot of truth in there, of course. If you change perspective, it's easier to see other people's perspectives. And I just spent a lot of time with Bermudians in Bermuda, and I have a different perspective of them. I spent time with people from Eastern Europe who were on the cruise. And however, it also requires some work on your behalf. It is not automatic. Travel does not automatically kill prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. It allows you to kill those things. It is a tool. So I just wanted to make a little statement about that. Travel can be fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, but it's up to you to do the work and notice what's going on around you so that those things will die. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 228. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. We have a fairly active community now on Discord. We have a Discord server. It's called Built to Go, a Discord server. And we have an active community on Facebook. It's called Built to Go, a Facebook group. I know, it's shocking. But if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember this quote by Mark Twain. "The best of us would rather be popular than right."